buying and selling of Revelations 13, 17. In Revelations 14, 9, speaking of the mark of the beast, it says, if any man worship the beast, take notice. It says, worship the beast. This issue is about worship, not economics. For a better understanding of this very important topic and to receive your three free books and a free DVD, call 1-888-211-1715. That's 1-888-211-1715.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Genesis Communication Network, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay on a beautiful, warm, sunny afternoon. I say that because my friends across America tell me how cold and miserable it is, but it is beautiful here today, and certainly looking out over the beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay is a privilege any time, even when it's stormy, but today it's beautiful. Well, today we're hoping to have with us from St. Louis, Missouri, our good friend William Federer, who's written a book recently on the Muslim faith. Now, he's written a lot of books, and we carry his books, America's God and Country, his book on George Washington Carver, his book, The Riddle of the Santa Claus, and his book on Saint Nicholas. There's so many books that we carry of William Federer's that all well worthwhile reading. But he's written a new book, going into the background of the Muslim faith, and I think we have to understand the Muslim faith. Fortunately, I don't think most Muslims do. I think that most Muslims throughout the world would just as soon raise their families and live a good life. And if the majority of the Muslims in the United States really followed the tenets of Muhammad, why this country, with all the Muslims we have here, would be in flames most of the time. The fact that we're not having any terrorist attacks by homegrown Muslims, other than those who were talked into making some extremist inflammatory statements by agent provocateurs, that they actually have to send out agent provocateurs to get Muslims in the United States to even suggest that they might engage in violent activity, reflects the fact that most Muslims really don't believe in this radical type of religion that was taught by Muhammad. But I think we have to understand what Muhammad taught, and then I think, of course, we have to understand that we are not fighting Islamic terrorists in Iraq. We're recruiting Islamic terrorists in Iraq and by our other activities in the Middle East. This whole radical Islamic movement had laid dormant since the defeat of the Muslim hordes in 1683 at the gates of Vienna. And certainly they were subdued under the Ottoman Empire, and then when that was, of course, defeated after the First World War by the they were subdued by the British and the French, who occupied their country and placed dictators over them, so that the average individual really had no freedom at all. And of course, the West has always worked with the dictators; they had to keep them in power. But always behind the scenes was working our intelligence agencies, trying to fan the flames of radical Islam. We have a wonderful book called The Devil's Game, and we recommend it to you, simply going into how this really started back in the 1870s with a man named Afghani, who was really a Persian, but he was actually recruited by British intelligence to begin to create this whole radical Islamic movement. And then when the Muslim Brotherhood was organized in 1928, why it was initially financed by the British intelligence, and of course in later years by American intelligence, and it was the American intelligence that brought CIA that brought Rockman to the United States, the blind sheikh Omar Rockman, and it was the American intelligence that had to have let al-Zawahiri, the number two man in al-Qaeda here in this country in 1985. Here was a man who was wanted for murder in Egypt, and yet he's allowed to come to the United States and travel over this country, and he was in Oklahoma City on the very date of the Oklahoma City bombing. But you've never heard that discussed any place. Pat Briley's brought that out in a number of recent articles. And so many of the people who've been involved in this whole radical Islamic movement have been working for the CIA and the FBI. And if you want to get into the background of that, there's the story of Ali Muhammad, who is the man who actually planned the bombing of the embassy in Tanzania and Kenya. And, of course, he was training the Mujahideen. He was training bin Laden's actually bodyguard while he was working for the Central Intelligence Agency. You really need to read Peter Lance's book, Triple Cross, to get into the background. Now, I would disagree with Peter. He thinks Ali Muhammad was using the FBI and the CIA. He was so much smarter than they were. But is it possible that Peter Lance is mistaken and he was always carrying out their directives all the way through? We'll be right back.
Are you looking for a one-stop shop to find all your favorite books and videos? Look no further. Northern Voice Bookstore has everything you need. Hundreds of titles, from self-defense, survival, and financial freedom, to history, politics, conspiracy, and everything you need to know about the New World Order. You can order everything you need on the web, 24 hours a day, at northernvoicebookstore.com. Or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, Post Office Box 281, Wildwood, PA, 15091. Northern Voice Bookstore offers a broad range of different perspectives and believes strongly that the American people need alternative sources of information in order to understand the society they live in today. You won't find a better selection of books or videos anywhere. So make Northern Voice Bookstore your bookstore. Visit us online at northernvoicebookstore.com or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, P.O. Box 281, Wildwood, PA 15091.
Do you know where the 78 potentially active volcanoes in U.S. are located? And do you know the locations of the top 300 prime terrorist targets? You can find these answers and more in the new interactive CD book, Prudent Places USA. With the more than 50 interactive parameters, you can pinpoint natural and man-made disaster areas, brewing environmental catastrophes, the safest cities, the best places for solar and wind energy, and much, much more. Complete with 3 gigabytes of detailed information on each of 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., including 550 high-resolution full-color maps and full-color photographs, as well as detailed information and analysis to help you zero in on the best places to live, the ideal location for cabins and vacation homes, as well as safe and unsafe areas. Get Prudent Places USA for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438 to order on the web or at BerkeyWater.com.
How are you feeling today? I ask because if you have health challenges, then reading our free booklet about the most amazing discovery of our time is crucial. The booklet is about an amazing fruit from Southeast Asia they call mangosteen. It's a centuries-old medicinal fruit whose time has come and it has amassed 40 years of published research. We have information and testimonials from all over the world about the health potentials of this amazing fruit. This powerful botanical has contributed to the well-being of millions of people the world over with health concerns just like yours. You can have the 22-page e-booklet absolutely free. We'll also refer you a website with links to actual testimonials and product information. Could this fruit help you in your quest for total health? Find out why mangosteen is known as the queen of all fruits and why it is fast becoming the best-selling wellness product ever brought to the market. Your health is in your hands. Do something about it today. Call 800-681-1909. Again, that's 800-681-1909.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and our guest today, of course, was William Federer. William, are you there? William Federer, are you there? Well, I'd hope, I know he's around someplace because I just talked to the producer, and he said he had him, and he was going to pass him right through. So as soon as William Federer gets on the line...
Hello.
Oh, there we are. Okay. Hey, it's good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Thank you so very much for coming on short notice. Well, why don't you tell our listeners about this great new book you've written?
Actually, there's two books probably that I haven't talked about since I've been on your show last. The first one is called The Original 13. And what I did is I researched the original 13 states and all their colonial charters and state constitutions and every amendment to every state constitution up to and including the present. And it's a documentary history of religion in America's first 13 states. And so, of course, as you would expect, every one of the colonial constitutions and charters mentions not only God, but Christianity and faith and propagating the gospel. You know, Delaware was founded by the Swedish Lutherans, and King Gustav Adolphus of Sweden, in his charter, he says that it was for the propagation of the Holy Gospel. And that's just an example of, and then I trace the history of each of these colonies all the way up to the present. And, you know, one in for example, is Maryland. Maryland was started as a colony for persecuted Catholics. They were ahead of their time, and they, in 1649, let any Christian hold office. And then the Virginia Anglicans decided to kick out the Puritans and the Quakers. And so the Puritans and Quakers didn't have anywhere to go, so Maryland allowed them to come in. After they were there for a little while, they the Puritans decided they could not in good conscience submit to a Catholic government, so they went down and sacked it and took it over. And then the King of England made it a royal colony and established the Church of England. And they actually passed laws that said if a guy dies and his widow marries a Catholic, the state would take the children away from the family. It was because of that that the Catholics were more than happy to join in the revolution against King George III. And then after the revolution, the very first state constitution of Maryland said every office holder must make a declaration of support to the state and a declaration of belief in the Christian religion. Well, now we look at that today and think, oh, they were so narrow-minded back then, saying only Christians could hold office. Well, they were being very progressive because they were saying that any Protestant denomination and then Catholics could hold office. Most of the other states still only allowed, at the time of the founding, only allowed Protestants to hold office. In North Carolina's state constitution of 1776, required every office holder to be Protestant. The same in Vermont, the same in New Hampshire, the same in Georgia. It wasn't until late 1700s that Catholics began to be able to hold office in most of the states. And it was sort of, you know, at the time of the founding, there was 98% of the country was Protestant, and about 2% were Catholic. And after the war, the country was indebted to everyone that was willing to take part in the revolution, and so the Catholics that fought in the revolution, the attitude was, well, they deserve the right to be able to worship if they're willing to die for our country. And so, and then in the early 1800s, there was a Thomas Kennedy in Maryland. He was a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian state legislator. He spent 8 years lobbying to allow Jews to hold office. At the time, he didn't even know a Jew, but he thought it wasn't right, and so they finally, in 1826, Maryland changed, they added the law to allow Jews to hold office, and then they changed their state constitution in 1851. And it says that every office holder had to make a declaration of belief to the state and profess the Christian religion, and if the party shall profess to be a Jew, the declaration shall be of a belief in a future state of rewards and punishments. And what I do in the book is it's a documentary history, so I trace each state all the way up to the present. For example, North Carolina, as I mentioned earlier, required all office holders to be Protestant. Now, this was a big step because just prior to the Revolution, the Church of England was the established church in North Carolina, and so the Baptists and Presbyterians and Methodists were all considered dissenters, and they didn't have equal rights. Well, the fact that it was for any Protestant enlarged tolerance of them. And then in 1835, North Carolina changed their constitution to allow any Christian to hold office. And then in 1877, North Carolina changed it again to allow anybody who believed in God to hold office. Now, I'm sure you're noticing, Dr. Stan, but the listeners may be noticing that these dates are well into our country's history. And so, if the First Amendment was written in 1789, yet North Carolina required all office holders to be Christian up until 1877, obviously the understanding back then was that the First Amendment, as well as the first 10 amendments, were simply to tie the federal government's hands from getting involved in what was under state's jurisdiction. And religion was so very, very important to them back then that they wanted to keep it under state's jurisdiction. And Joseph Story was a Supreme Court justice put on the court by James Madison, of all people. James Madison was the one who introduced the First Amendment in Congress. And Joseph Story started Harvard Law School, and he wrote this. He said, the whole power over the subject of religion is left exclusively to the state governments to be acted on according to their own sense of justice and their state constitutions. And so that's why when we want to find out what the founders thought about religion, instead of looking at the federal constitution, which simply tells what the federal government can't do, we need to look at the state constitutions. And indeed, every one of them mentioned Christianity, and even today, it's interesting, Virginia's state constitution today still mentions Christianity. It says, it's the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity one toward another. That's what it says. It carries that on from the original state constitution. It says that it's a mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity one towards another. And the North Carolina's 1971 state constitution, Article 11, Section 4, says, beneficent provision for the poor, the unfortunate, the orphans, is one of the first duties of a civilized and Christian state. So North Carolina still calls itself a Christian state. And so it, again, highlights the fact that the First Amendment wasn't to get God out of the country. The First Amendment was to tie the federal government's hands from getting involved in what was under state's jurisdiction, and religion was so very, very important back then, they wanted to keep it under state's jurisdiction. Sort of like local control of the school board, local control of the fire department, it was local control of religion.
And of course, this is never taught in our schools today. It's never taught in our law schools, and I dare say that there's probably not one of our Supreme Court justices who is even aware of these things because they've been all educated in modern-day law schools. In fact, you're a lawyer. Did you ever learn any of these things in law school?
Well, actually, my dad and three brothers are attorneys, and I've taken law classes because I have a degree in accounting, but this has never been taught. And I've talked to lawyers, including those in my family and others, and they are taught the case precedent theory. People say, well, when did it change? Well, there were three ingredients that made it change. Number one is in 1846, there was an Irish potato famine, and millions of Irish Catholics came to America. At the time of the Revolution, 2% of the country was Catholic. After the Irish potato famine, 20% of the country was Catholic. A huge immigration, so there was backlash. And laws began to be passed to basically discriminate against Catholics. But the setting was this. In the major cities, they had schools for each denomination. The Presbyterians had their school, you know, like Princeton. The Congregationalists had their schools, like Harvard and Yale. And then for the poor in the inner cities, they started common schools, where they only taught what was held in common, such as the King James Bible. It wasn't a Baptist book. It wasn't an Anglican book. It wasn't a Presbyterian book. Everybody used the King James Bible until the Catholics came over, and they objected to it. There were demonstrations in the streets that in Boston where the Father Wiggins told the little Catholic boys that he would read their names out loud at church if they said the Ten Commandments in the Protestant order. Most people don't know that they're numbered differently between the Protestants and the Catholics. Same content. The Catholics have the first two combined. I'm the Lord thy God, I shall know the gods before me, and thou shalt not make unto thyself any graven image. That's those two are combined. And then the last one is split. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, and thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. But it's the same content. But yet there were demonstrations in the street, and of course the Protestants teaching in these common schools didn't help out the situation much because they were teaching that the Pope was the Antichrist and that the Inquisition killed a whole bunch of people. And so the Catholics pulled their kids out of the public schools, the common schools, and put them into parochial schools, and then asked for tax help. They thought, well, gee, we're 20% of the country now. We're paying taxes. Can we get some of this money for our schools? Well, there was a big backlash, and the Blaine Amendments were passed. James Blaine was a Maine senator, and he tried to pass a national one, but it didn't pass. So it went on state levels, and these Blaine Amendments were to keep tax money from going to Catholic schools. But they didn't call them Catholic, they called them sectarian schools. But everybody knew this law, these laws were referring to Catholics because only the Catholics were asking for funds. And so they passed all across the country. these Blaine amendments to prevent tax money from going to Catholic schools. Well, of course, after the centuries have gone by, now the courts look at these anti-sectarian laws and think, oh, well, this means any tax money is not supposed to go to any Christian school or religious purpose or whatever. But that was the first ingredient. The second ingredient was the 14th Amendment.
All right, we're going to ask you to hold up on that. I guess it's William Federer. And, Bill, what's the title of the book?
Original 13.
The Original 13. We're going to carry this book.
In America's First 13 States.
I think it's a great book, and we're certainly going to carry it here. But we'll be back in just a moment with William Federer. Have you made preparations to look after yourself and your family in case it's a national emergency or a terrorist attack? Well, I want to tell you that the government's looking after their people. In fact, plans have been made to protect people of high-ranking position in government, but they're not making any preparations for the average individual, so you're going to have to look after yourself. If you'd like information on long-term food storage, if you'd like information on the other items you would need in case of a national emergency, why don't you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the emergency food catalog. We'll get it right off to you and we'll get the items shipped directly from Ready Reserve Foods. That's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You're going to have to begin making preparations to look after yourself.
Hi, folks. Jack Brownrigg from Midas Resources. The real money, folks. Let's review a few things from the past year, November 2003 to November 2004. The Dow has ranged from 9,800 to 10,300, a 5% increase. The dollar's value has dropped from 96 cents to 70 cents against the euro, a 24% decrease in spending power against the gold-backed euro. Gold has gone from the 390s to the 440s, a 16% increase in real money. Precious metals are the safe haven in today's hectic marketplace. To learn how to protect your shrinking dollar, call Midas Resources today at 1-800-686-2237. Remember, gold is liquid, private, and portable. Call now before your buying power shrinks even more dramatically. That's Midas Resources at 800-686-2237.
The war on terrorism, will it be fought overseas or will it affect us here at home? If you are like most folks, you want to be prepared but can't afford an underground shelter. So what do you do? Did you know that you can use your home as a shelter against fallout and biological or chemical attacks? With a little know-how, it's not that difficult. Sheltering in place, surviving acts of terrorism from biological, chemical, and radioactive fallout, developed by Wayne LeBaron, a health physicist who has served as a specialist in environmental health, communicable diseases, and has worked as a nuclear specialist for the U.S. government, gives you easy-to-follow video instructions and walks you step-by-step through the process of preparing your home as a shelter. Get this critical video every American needs for only $29 plus shipping. Order by calling New Millennium today at 888-803-4438. That's 888-803-4438. Or order on the web at BerkeyWater.com.
Hi, I'm Joyce Riley, and many of you know that for years I was a cardiovascular heart transplant nurse. Since that time, I have educated myself on the importance of preventative care. It all begins with providing your heart and vascular system with the building blocks for good health. Strauss Heart Drops is the original formula that was copied by others but never duplicated. Strauss Heart Drops were developed by a master herbalist, Jim Strauss, after he suffered a heart attack in 1979. His doctor said he would only survive if he had heart bypass surgery, and Jim said no. He developed Strauss Heart Drops, the formula that has been copied by others but never been surpassed. Get the original Strauss Heart Drops 4-ounce bottle for only $79.99. Call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. 877-817-9829. You've probably heard about the other products that have tried to copy the Strauss formula. Well, get the original Strauss Heart Drops by calling 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Now you can really do your heart right with Strauss Heart Drops.
Well, I'd like to stand back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and We're talking about Bill Federer's book, The Original 13. A very important thing for you to have, for you can document the fact that our founding fathers recognized that America was founded by Christians as a Christian nation based upon the Christian faith. But this is never taught in school today because there really are people who hate Christianity, who would destroy the religious foundation of this nation and supplant it with an authoritarian society, as is happening so rapidly today. So I really applaud you, Bill, for getting the documentation out there and going to the original source material so people can understand that those of us who say that America was founded as a Christian nation really understood this. Now, that did not mean that the federal government stipulated Christianity was the official religion, although there's much to suggest that they acknowledge that. It was to keep the federal government out of religion, and the matters dealing with life, liberty, property, and religion were to be left to the states. Is that correct?
Right. It's imagine when the UN Charter was written in San Francisco in 1945. Most of the people in America did not have a clue what was going on out there. But as long as our federal constitution wasn't being messed with, we really didn't care. And that's the attitude that was in America at the time the Constitution was written. That even Patrick Henry said something fishy is going on in Philadelphia, but they didn't know what was going on. It was a secret meeting. They couldn't. None of the writings were being published. All was going on. But the attitude in the country was, as long as you don't mess with my state constitution, then we're okay. And that was the idea, that the state constitutions were actually more important to these very individualistic sovereign states at the time of the country's founding. And so religion was under each one. And each state had its own preferred denomination. New York originally was founded by the Dutch Reformed. Virginia was Church of England. It was had the established Church of England from 1606 to 1786. Established meant three things: mandatory membership, mandatory taxes to support it, and you couldn't hold office unless you were a member. So in Virginia, if you wanted to hold public office, you had to be an Anglican. They actually had church wardens that would come by and collect the tithe if you didn't pay. In the late 1700s, Thomas Jefferson helped found the Calvinistical Reformed Church in the Albemarle County Courthouse. It went on for like 8 years. Charles Clay was the pastor. And Thomas Jefferson thought he had invented something new. It was a voluntary church, and that the members would annually pay a subscription to help finance the church. And so there wasn't any state warden collecting the tithes to support the church. In Connecticut, it was congregational. It was started by Thomas Hooker, who was chased out of Boston, and he founded Hartford, Connecticut with his church. Matter of fact, Thomas Hooker gave a sermon on which he said every church member should have a vote in the church business. Well, the church members wrote that down, and it became the fundamental constitutions of the state of Connecticut, of the colony of Connecticut, so that every member of the colony got to have a vote. And guess what? Connecticut was called the Constitution State. You go there today and see their license plate, it says the Constitution State, because that's because the Connecticut Constitution was the blueprint for the U.S. Constitution, the idea that everybody gets to vote. So in other words, our government, our state government, was modeled after the church government there in Connecticut. Rhode Island was predominantly Baptist. It's interesting, it was the one state that had absolutely no religious requirements to hold office. And you read their charter of 1663, and it says because we want to put these gospel principles into practice, that if we require people to be Christian to hold public office, they may not be Christian and may just simply be hypocrites, and that's not pleasing to God. And so they didn't want people being hypocrites. They wanted them to be genuine, and so that's why they didn't require it. So it's funny because the most evangelical of the states being founded by Baptists was the one that required the least, because they understood that the true religion was from the inside out, not forced from the government from the outside in. New Hampshire was originally Church of England and then became congregational. New York was Dutch Reformed. It was originally New Amsterdam and founded by the Dutch, and they had established the Dutch denomination, the Dutch Reformed. There was an instance where Lutherans began to settle there and have little home Lutheran meetings, and the Dutch Reform pastors went to Peter Stuyvesant, the governor, and complained, saying, how can you allow this to take place because the Dutch Reform is the only church allowed? The Quakers began to move into New York and then other denominations, and they loosened up a little bit, and then New Amsterdam became New York, and then the British came in and bought the Church of England. So each state had their own story, but when you look at all these together, it
hold
gives
that
you an
right,
understanding
hold that
of why
right
they
there.
Wrote the First Amendment.
Hold that right there, Bill. He's right back.
Order a copy of this show for your friends and family at GCNLive.com or call 877-300-7645.
Use Cartabite know about the pollutants in our body and want them out. For over 5 years, Cartabite has proven itself time-tested. Here's Dr. Mattson, a naturopathic doctor's thoughts on Cartabite.
In our mind, there isn't such a great big mystery to disease anymore. This basic tenet of yeast in the gut and metals in the liver covers at least 70-80% of the diseases that we see. When we do our program, you know, herbal formulas like Cartabite, and you see someone who could barely walk up a hill now going for regular jogs, few months later, we know we're doing something right. It's a well thought out formula. I mean, the idea of it working on yeast and metals both at the same time and liver function is dead on. You'll find, I think, that it'll work more than just on heart problems and circulation problems. It'll work on other problems as well.
For more information, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit our website at www.heartdrop.com. That toll free number again, 1-877-928-8822.
Hello, folks. This is Alex Jones introducing you to the incredible Berkey Solar Charger, your source for free solar electricity. This portable system is the size of a book when folded and small enough to fit into a briefcase, handbag, or glove compartment. The Berkey Solar Charger has been designed to power the Berkey Lights LED lamps as well as other applications such as mobile phones, radios, digital cameras, and PDAs when electricity is not available. Its multi-voltage capabilities, multiple adapters, and rechargeable batteries provide for a flexible source of auxiliary backup power. Simply place the Berkey Solar Charger in the sun, plug in your application, and you have power. Disconnect your application, the system automatically begins charging its own rechargeable batteries. Get the incredible Berkey Solar Charger for only $75 by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. And tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's toll-free, 888-803-4438.
It's a fact. You can legally eliminate credit card debt, which has been fraudulently created by the banks. Since its creation in 1913, the Federal Reserve has not been held responsible for its own debt. So why should you, the hardworking American, be harassed for yours? There's a double standard when it comes to being responsible for debt, and unlike the Federal Reserve, the people of this country can't print more money when needed. Day of Jubilee has created a successful program designed for people that want to stop harassing calls and threatening letters from bill collectors. We also do credit restoration. Join the thousands of Americans who now breathe a sigh of relief because they have legally eliminated their credit card debt instead of living each day in fear. It's time to turn your life around. Call Day of Jubilee, open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Standard Time at 920-293-8024. That's 920-293-8024, and ask for Robert. Don't wait any longer to get your life back in order.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is William Federer. And William, why don't you get your website out, your telephone number? People know how to get in touch with you. And it sounds like a really great book. How much does the book cost?
It's $25, and it's 400 pages, and it has every single reference to faith from all the colonial charters, all the state constitutions, up to the present. So the 2002 Connecticut Constitution, all these different things are in there. You get to see not only is God still mentioned in just about all of them, that it's the Christian faith that's specifically mentioned. But anyway, the book's the original 13. It's called The Documentary History of Religion in America's First 13 States. And my website's AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And I also send out a free daily email called The American Minute.
And they're always excellent, and Bill's material is great, and we're going to be carrying that book, and I'll have my girls call and order half a dozen of them from you. But Bill really does tremendous research. We're indebted to him for so much of the historical research that is available today on understanding the foundations of our freedom. So once again, the telephone number and of course, the website.
My toll-free number is 888-USA-WORD. That's 888-USA-WORD. And the website is AmericanMinute.com.
Okay, very good. Well, why don't you go on with the story?
Well, it's interesting. I'm just going to read a couple of these because they're just so eye-opening. Here's the Constitution of Massachusetts, 1780, which is actually the oldest continuously used constitution in the world. It predates our U.S. Constitution by 7 years. It was written by John Adams. And in there, it says the state may lay a tax for the support of public Protestant teachers of piety and religion. And John Adams was very proud of this because he understood that the free government could not sustain itself unless the people were taught the principles that underlay the free government, and that was the principles from the Bible. And so he specifically says in there, Article 3, that the state may lay a tax for the support and maintenance of public Protestant teachers of piety and religion. Clearly, John Adams was involved in the country's founding, and he didn't want to get rid of God. He goes on to say this. He goes, in every denomination of Christians, demeaning themselves peacefully and as good subjects of the commonwealth, shall be equally under the protection of the law, and no subordination of any one denomination to another shall ever be established by law. And so that was the understanding. It was the simply not to have one denomination preferred over another. Here's New Hampshire's Constitution, 1784. Part 2, form of government, says that no person shall be capable of being elected a senator who is not of the Protestant religion. House of Representatives, North New Hampshire, every member of the House of Representatives shall be of the Protestant religion. Here's Vermont's, which became the 14th state. It was part of New Hampshire at the time of the founding. 1777, each member shall take his seat and make the declaration, I believe in one God, creator and governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good, the punisher of the wicked, and I acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration, and I own and profess the Protestant religion. I mentioned Maryland already. It says and every office holder had to make a declaration of belief in the Christian religion. That was 1776. New Jersey's state constitution of 1776, Article 19, it says there shall be no establishment of any one religious sect in this province in preference to another, and that no Protestant inhabitant of this colony shall be denied the enjoyment of any civil right, but all persons professing a belief in the faith of any Protestant sect shall be equally under protection of the law. And I'm just reading these. These are everybody goes to great extents to dissect the federal constitution, and they never bother looking at the state constitutions, which govern the everyday lives of the people. Here's Pennsylvania's constitution, which was more liberal than the others, other than Rhode Island. It was signed by Ben Franklin, the president or governor of the new state of Pennsylvania. September 28, 1776, Section 10, and each member, before he takes his seat, shall make and subscribe the following declaration. I do believe in one God, the creator and governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good, the punisher of the wicked, and I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. And no further or other religious test shall hereafter be required of any civil officer. Here is Ben Franklin, who everybody, you know, cites him as being the more liberal of the founders. He signs the Constitution of Pennsylvania, which requires every office holder to not only lay their hand on the Bible to swear into office, they had to believe in the Bible. They had to believe in, quote, acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. And again, here's Delaware. Now, Delaware's state constitution was written by George Reed and Thomas McKean. And now those names are significant because they both signed the Declaration of Independence. So when they wrote this, Article 3, 22, says every person chosen a member of either house shall make the declaration, I do profess faith in God the Father, and Jesus Christ, His only Son, the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore, and I acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Now, again, we look at that today and think, oh, my goodness, they were so narrow-minded back then, saying only people that believed in God the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost could hold office. Guess what? They thought they were being very progressive and liberal and generous, and, in fact, they were as compared to the colonial era, where Delaware used to be Lutheran. And that was the established denomination until it was taken over by the Dutch briefly, and then it was taken over by the British, where they established the Church of England. And so this not only allowed all the Protestants to hold office, it even allowed Catholics to hold office. Delaware was one of the four states that originally allowed Catholics to hold office. I mentioned North Carolina's earlier. Here's South Carolina's, 1778. State constitution says no person who shall be eligible for a seat in the Senate unless he shall be of the Protestant religion and shall reach the age of 30 years old. Here's Georgia's state constitution, Article 6. In 1777, representatives shall be chosen out of each county, and they shall be of the Protestant religion. Here's Connecticut's constitution, Connecticut was unique. They didn't write a state constitution until 1818. They just continued to use their colonial charter, which, as I mentioned earlier, was written after a sermon by Thomas Hooker, who was the congregational minister. And so Connecticut's constitution had the established congregational church up until 1818. That's right. After the Declaration was written, after the Constitution, after the First Amendment, Connecticut still had the congregational denomination as of the established denomination. In other words, mandatory membership, mandatory tax to support it. You couldn't hold office in Connecticut unless you were a member of the Congregational Church. Now, they thought they would be very liberal by allowing other dissenting denominations to be there. The Baptists and the Anglicans and the Presbyterians, and they even bent over backwards, they thought, and allowed the taxes that were paid by these dissenting denominations to be funneled to their dissenting churches. All the members had to do was to go down to the courthouse and register that they were dissenters. Now, that was in 1795, they made that change, and so in 1801 is when the Danbury Baptists in Connecticut wrote a letter complaining to Thomas Jefferson. And in their letter, which I have in my book, they say, we realize that you are not the national legislator and that you have no power as president to destroy the laws of the different states. But hopefully your influence, like the rays that shine forth from the sun, can have a genial disposition to allow freedom to expand, you know. And so they admit that Jefferson had no say, but Jefferson writes back and he says, I agree with you that religion is something between man and his God, and that he owes no account of it to the state because there's a wall of separation between church and state. And so we see here that finally in 1818, Connecticut changed its constitution to disestablish the Congregational Church. Sort of an interesting way in which it happened. Deism began to come into the country, and the Unitarians and the Universalists began to drop out of church. And so the church just had a smaller group of serious Christians in there with their serious Christian pastors, but everybody in the community had to pay the taxes to support their congregational church and the congregational minister. Well, it suddenly dawned on the Unitarians and the Universalists that as the community, they could vote who the pastor was going to be, and so they voted in one of their liberal Unitarian pastors into the church that had these serious Christians. And that caused great dismay to these Christians because they had this pastor there that was preaching the opposite of what they believed. And so they finally left the church and let the property go to the Unitarians. And then once they were kicked out, or they left, they began to lobby to disestablish the Congregational Church because they saw it was no longer to their advantage. So a little interesting turn of events there in Connecticut. New York was probably one of the most liberal. The reason being is that it was originally New Amsterdam, a Dutch colony, and when the British took it over, the British couldn't force all these Dutch-speaking people to convert and speak English and be Anglican, so they just let them continue sort of as second class, but they officially established the Church of England as a church that would get the taxes and get the property and build the great big buildings, and everybody else had to support them. And it was sort of like the favored church. Well, because they didn't force everybody to switch their religion, after a while, with New York being a big port city, you got Jews that came in, you got Lutherans and Quakers and just about every different denomination. Not Catholics, though. There weren't any Catholics in New York until 1784, till after the Revolution, was the first Catholic church was established. And 1805 was when the Catholic diocese in New York was established. So there really weren't too many Catholics, only Maryland. There was not one Catholic in the entire state of Georgia until after the Revolutionary War. The first Catholic church in Virginia was 1795. We're talking after the Revolution, after the Constitution. And so we see that, you know, you drop a pebble in the pond, the ripples go out. So each of these different states, like a racetrack with 13 lanes, each state progressed at a different speed to enlarge the religious tolerance from just their particular favored denomination, then to all the different Protestants, then to begin to tolerate Catholics, and then tolerate Jews. Maryland, Rhode Island being the first to allow Jews, then Pennsylvania, and then Maryland, and then New York. The first synagogue in New York was 1730, but the first synagogue in Rhode Island was 1763, and the first old synagogue in Virginia was, wasn't until into the 1800s. But anyway, so you can sort of see, that was Massachusetts. The first synagogue in Massachusetts was in 1840. So you can see that this was a trend, and I began to, I know I'm sort of on a roll here, but interrupt me at any time, Dr. Stan.
Oh, don't you worry, I will.
There were three ingredients that changed from the state's jurisdiction. The first one was the tremendous influx of Irish Catholic immigrants in the 1840s and 50s because of the Irish potato famine, and then the backlash to that. The second was the 14th Amendment. Now, for those that aren't familiar, we had a civil war. Slavery was ended. We passed the 13th Amendment, which forbade slavery in the states. The 13th Amendment was different, though, from the first 10. The first 10 amendments were the states limiting the federal government's power. If you read the history of the country, the different states did not want to ratify this new government. They were afraid they were creating a big centralized monster like they just rebelled against with the king. And so promises were made from James Madison and several others that they would put limitations on this new federal government in the very first session of Congress. And we call these limitations the first 10 amendments or the Bill of Rights. I refer to them as 10 handcuffs on the power of the federal government. So this was limiting the federal government, but the 13th Amendment was basically the federal government telling the states that they were limited from not having slavery. Now, thank God for that. The states should have gotten rid of slavery on their own, but they didn't. And but what happened in the Deep South is states like Georgia and South Carolina freed the slaves, but they did not give the freed slaves state citizenship. And the federal government couldn't force them to do it. And the federal government, there was no such thing as a federal citizen. And so here, these freed slaves were in legal limbo. They couldn't hold office, they couldn't vote, they couldn't own property, they couldn't sue, they couldn't defend themselves in court. They had no legal standing because they were non-citizens of the state, like Indians. And so some Republicans in Congress, led by John Bingham of Ohio, pushed through the 14th Amendment for the sole purpose of giving rights to the freed slaves. And once somebody said to John Bingham that maybe the federal courts might in the future use the 14th Amendment to intervene and take other rights away from the states. And John Bingham said, I repel the suggestion that this amendment would ever be used by the federal government to take rights away from the states. Well, guess what? That's exactly what they did. And that's where the third ingredient comes in, evolution. When Charles Darwin came up with his theory in 1859 that species could evolve, in the late 1800s, Christopher Columbus Langdale was the dean of the Harvard Law School, and he came up with the idea that laws should evolve and the Constitution should evolve. And he came up with this case precedent theory of law, that instead of going back and figuring out what the founders intended, you look at the most recent case and use that as the basis, and then you can, you know, bend the steel rod bit by bit from there. And so it was the idea that laws could evolve in little pieces. So those are the three ingredients, the Catholic immigration, the 14th Amendment, and then this evolution. And then what happened after that was there were the Mormons. And the Mormons began to say the First Amendment allowed them to have multiple wives. And a case went to the federal court, and then it went to the Supreme Court. And in the 1890s, the Supreme Court had to make a decision on the interpretation of the First Amendment, saying the First Amendment does not allow you to have as many wives as you want. It goes, I'm sorry, this is a Christian nation, and this is the laws of all Christian nations forbid polygamy. And then there in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, there were the Jehovah's Witnesses. In the 1920s, the Jehovah's Witnesses would go into neighborhoods and knock on doors and come inside and put a phonograph record on for the people to listen to, and the phonograph record would attack Christianity, in particular the Catholic Church, but basically all Christian doctrine. And it became obnoxious, where people in neighborhoods after neighborhoods were complaining. So there was a court case that was brought, and it stopped it.
All right, we're going to have to let you go. We're out of time, Bill. We'll get you on the evening program. We'll go over a full 2 hours. How's that?
Sounds great. And then I got a new book on what every American needs to know about the Quran.
All right, we'll talk about that later. I'll get in touch with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back here.
American Discount Home Medical Equipment sells at discount prices. We sell wheelchairs, oxygen equipment, hospital beds, commodes, bath safety products, walkers, and other items needed for the care of your loved one at home. Our phone number is 1-800-956-6616. We sell at one half of retail price or less. We have free shipping and no sales tax for any shipment outside of California. You can expect to receive the item within 7 days. Our website address is www.home-med-equip.com. Again, our phone number is 1-800-956-6616.
Terrorism, terrorism, chemical attacks, dirty bombs, fallout, biological attack, anthrax, and to top it all off, duct tape and plastic. Alarming words for our time. But how do you protect your family during such a crisis? The video Sheltering in Place, Surviving Acts of Terrorism from Biological, Chemical, and Radioactive Fallout was developed by Wayne LeBaron, a health physicist who has served as a specialist in environmental health, communicable diseases, and has worked as a nuclear specialist for the U.S. government. Anyone can follow the simple instructions. It's presented by a housewife as they walk you step-by-step through the process of preparing your home as a shelter. If you're not the type who waits till it's too late, then you need the video Sheltering in Place. Get the critical information you need now for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438 and tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438 or order on the web at murkywater.com.
Attention, attention everyone. A brand new invention just released. It's called WristEase, the new patented portable ergonomic wrist support. WristEase comforts your wrists from the sometimes painful tasks of typing, writing, using a mouse, or adding machine. Unlike most conventional wrist pads that are either attached to a mouse pad or lay flat in front of your keyboard, WristEase is totally portable and ideal for laptop users and technicians who are constantly on the go. WristEase is perfect for children doing homework or playing video games. WristEase provides the proper comfort and support for all ages, and WristEase provides comfort for victims of carpal tunnel syndrome and other repetitive injuries. You can order WristEase now at WristEase.com. That's WristEase, W-R-I-S-T-E-A-S-E, WristEase.com. Once again, WristEase.com.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and if you'd like to get Bill's book, The Original 13, why, you give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. It's $24.95 plus shipping, and it sounds like a great book. I've enjoyed all of Bill's books, and we do carry his America's God and Country, his book on George Washington Carver, his book on there really is a St. Nicholas, and so if you'd like to get one of our catalogs, go and look up on the Internet all the books we carry that Bill has put out, and they're all excellent, excellent sources of documentation. And this one sounds like a very important book. The Original 13, The Original 13. So we're going to carry it and hope you'll want to get a copy if don't miss. And then, of course, we certainly want to mention that everything looks like we're going to go to war with Iran. They might surprise us. They might be able to topple the government, have the CIA go in there and pull another coup off, as we did in 53 when we overthrew the legitimately voted-in democratic government of Iran under Premier Mossadegh, or as we did again in 1979 when we overthrew the government of the Shah of Iran that we had installed there. We installed the mullahs over there today, so maybe we can replace them as well. After all, we installed Saddam Hussein. We've been backing the government in Saudi Arabia, the tyrannical government there, both there and in Kuwait. These are feudal monarchies. We certainly were working with the Pakistanis when they installed the current military dictatorship. We're helping to establish dictatorships throughout the world. We are occupying South Korea. We've been occupying them for 50 years. We're occupying Japan, and we're occupying Germany, and we control the economies of those countries, and we control their political structure. We have our troops permanently stationed there, and when you've got your troops stationed in a country, you control that country. Well, understand what's really going on today. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get my talk on the world revolution. You need to get our talk on Iraq, the untold story, and the syllabus that goes with that. There's so much material out there. But then to get into the spiritual forces that energize this, you need to get my pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. The occult hierarchy. There are three little pamphlets, our newsletters. We put them together in pamphlet form. Certainly you want to get the book Hostage to the Devil. You want to get the book Satanic Crimes. Incidentally, if you get Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin, you should get the four-tape set because you'll get it at a reduced price. But you need to have the information. You need to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And tragically, there are an awful lot of boys who are dying over there in Iraq in another no-win war, just like Vietnam was a no-win war. I mean, if they'd wanted to win the war, they would have sent in adequate men at the beginning instead of sending in 160,000 men, which used 695,000 men back in 1991 to shoo the forces out of, shoo the Saddam's forces out of Kuwait, not to engage them, but just to drive them out of the country, and that's all they did. And yet they used 160,000 men to take and then to occupy and control the country after we destroyed the army and the military and the police and the factories and the civil service. Do you honestly think that they're that stupid? They're not that stupid at all. They wanted the chaos, and they sure got it, didn't they? Well, you need to read my newsletters up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. August, September, October, November, December. Actually, of course, is what really happened on 9-1-1, but when you understand that 9-1-1 was used simply as the excuse to get us into a war that was long ago planned, and we're following a timetable, a spiritual timetable, which is ticking and bringing us rapidly towards the climax in history. Well, we hope you've made your preparations. If you haven't, you know, for the difficult times that lay ahead, you need to start laying in food supplies and water. You need to be able to purify your water. You need to be able to have it in storage. You need the pumps for it. We have catalogs. If you'd like to get the health catalog, the food storage catalog, or the regular catalog, or a free newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And we'll be back here in just a moment for the next hour right here at Radio Liberty.
Hello, folks. Alex Jones here introducing...
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, this afternoon, for this hour, our guest is our good friend, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who has taught at the university level, who was in the White House Department of Education during the Reagan years, who's testified before Congress, and has written extensively. He writes regular articles for Dudes with Views. He's written a number of excellent books, many of which we carry. Many of them are out of print. And, of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to helping us get Dr. Cuddy's book, Secret Records Revealed, back in print. And we have a project to do that and hope we're well on our way towards getting the pledges so we can get Secret Records Revealed. But we'll tell you more about the books of Dr. Cuddy's that we do carry in just a minute. But right now we're going to be talking about Dr. Cuddy's latest article on newswithviews.com. Dr. Cuddy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so you pick up the story there.
Well, the latest item I posted on News with Views is What Are We Doing in Iraq, Part 2. That's a successor to the previous column that I had, and the way I pick up on this particular part is by getting with President Bush's January 23rd State of the Union speech, where he states regarding American foreign policy that, quote, our work in the world is also based on a timeless truth, to whom much is given, much is required, end quote. And the way I began by using that is, he didn't identify what this timeless truth was or where it came from. And actually, well, what he's doing is using Luke chapter 12, verse 48. And I suspect perhaps he didn't refer to it specifically as from the Bible, is that if one looks at that immediately after that particular sentence, Luke 12, 48 states, quote, and to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more, end quote. And the reason I begin that way is one of the things our soldiers have been and are and will be asking President Bush is why they have been fighting and dying in Iraq for his failed policies there. There's a case that many people make about weapons of mass destruction and why we went there. And actually, I'm one of the few, I guess, who still believe that they really did have them because, for one thing, we gave them to them when they used it against Iran, so it's really a question of what they did with them, whether they destroyed them, and I doubt it, or put them in some sort of van and shipped them over to Syria or someplace. But those things people can disagree on. What I find particularly disturbing is that now he says we have this new strategy, and we've been there longer than the entire Second World War. And right from the beginning, I pointed out in one of the books that you cover with Radio Liberty called Cover Up. Most of that's about 9/11, the terrorist attack, but there is a chapter about Iraq, and I actually wrote that before the invasion of Iraq and said in there, if any of your listeners want to look at that book, get that book from me, they will see in there describe what Saddam Hussein's secret strategy was going to be, which the leadership in the country, I remember for about 9 months, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney would appear on Tim Russert's Meet the Press, and over again he would ask them, are you sure you know what the Iraqis are up to? Oh, yes, no urban guerrilla war, no, none of that. And I had indicated from a Iraqi lieutenant general who had tried to overthrow Saddam some years earlier and had left the country, that is exactly what he planned. They would lay low for a while, then they would engage in this urban guerrilla warfare. They had these deposits of weapons all around the country.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And our special guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, a personal friend who has taught at the university level and has written extensively. We carry a number of his books. But today he's talking about an article he has posted on newswithviews.com, the website. And it's What Are We Doing in Iraq, Part 2? And Dr. Cuddy is simply pointing out that although the administration claims they had no idea that Saddam would engage in guerrilla warfare, after our invasion, Dr. Cuddy had written in his book, Cover Up, that that's exactly what was planned. In fact, he was simply quoting an Iraqi general who had defected to the West, who had told our leaders exactly what was going to happen. They were going to stand aside and let us move right on in, and once we got into Baghdad, they were going to undertake guerrilla warfare. And Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney simply systematically lied to the American people. In fact, they did everything they could to facilitate the guerrilla warfare by disbanding the Iraqi army and disbanding the Iraqi police force and disbanding the civil service and closing down the factories where people had jobs. These were the government factories, so there was no place for people to work, no place for them to get a job, no place for them to support their families. And the leaders of our country are not stupid. They knew what was going to happen. They just couldn't let the American people know that we've wanted this terrible chaos. How else could we justify staying there? I mean, we went into Afghanistan to catch Osama bin Laden. We didn't get him, but we stayed in this Afghanistan. We went into Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein, and once we deposed him, we stayed in Afghanistan. Just like we defeated the Germans back in 1945, our troops are still there. We defeated the Japanese in 1945, our troops are still there. We entered the Korean War in 1955. Our troops are still there. Why would you think we're going to pull our troops out of Iraq simply because we had taken the country? I mean, after all, to the victor goes the spoils. But you have to have a justification, and that's just what has happened. The chaos gives us a justification for staying on and continuing the fight, and American boys bleed and suffer and die, but they're not allowed to win the war. They were never sent there to win the war. We were never given adequate troops to win the war. And of course, the Al-Qaeda terrorists are being, well, often financed by our good friends in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Pick the story up there, Dr. Cuddy.
Sure. The the Lieutenant General's Tawfiq, T-A-W-F-I-K, Al-Yassiri, is the one who said, well, you know, this is what they're going to do. They're going to take off any uniforms. They'll look just like average people. They'll wait around, and they've been really well-trained.
Hold that thought.
Well-trained in the West.
Well, Dr. Cuddy is just pointing out that the general who had defected to the West long before our attack told us exactly what was going to happen, that the members of the Republican Guard were going to take off the uniforms, fade into the community, and then, of course, as soon as things appeared to be quieting down, they were going to begin their guerrilla warfare. Certainly, our leaders had access to the same information Dr. Cuddy did, and he wrote in his book, Cover Up, which we carry, which was actually published before the invasion, or at least completed before the invasion, exactly what was going to happen. And yet Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney assured the American people there was not going to be any guerrilla warfare, just as President Bush is assuring us today there is no civil war going on in Iraq. This is not a civil war. Go ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Sure, and so That's why I begin this part two with the question that a lot of soldiers are asking and will continue to, you know, why I'm over here fighting and dying in Iraq for failed policies. Never mind, you know, whether they're weapons of mass destruction or not. Whenever if you're a general, or if you know any generals or retired generals, if you ask them just flat out, suppose you misjudge your enemy's strategy, could that cost your soldiers' lives? They say, of course it could. And so for 3.5 years, they have been just, by and large, ignoring what was going on, keeping, you know, the pot sort of stirred up there, a low-level chaos, now into a civil war, a power struggle that is sectarian in nature, and so on. And so I continue this particular article by saying on Meet the Press, on Sunday morning, January 21, you had a couple of senators, Republican John McCain and Democrat Ted Kennedy, and they were the guests, and they were giving their opposing views on the solution. You know, here's what we should do, and so forth, withdraw to defensible areas, and so on, the usual stuff. And as I was watching that, I thought, you know, this could be on George Stephanopoulos's show this week or CBS's Face the Nation. And it's almost like the camera was on rewind and they keep replaying this stuff because it was just a repetition of the generalities that we've heard for 4 years. You know, the standard pap that they come out with, you know, well, here's what we're doing and so forth. And so the point is that it appeared to me that the guests and the hosts and most Americans never get beyond that sort of surface mentality, the sort of general questions. And so what I decided to do in this part two is actually go through point by point, which is what any commander-in-chief should do, or any, you know, police chief in a city or whatever it is, and show what the problems were, and if they'd done this sort of stuff before they even went into Iraq under normal conditions, we wouldn't have made the mistakes we did. However, my caveat is that, of course, that's not why we're really there anyway. So the Bush administration is now talking about this new strategy, and it's entailing a surge of 20,000 or so troops to basically give the Iraqi National Army time to be trained to take over the burden of providing security for its own people. Now, you know, on face value, that's the sort of surface generality that sounds reasonable. Uh-huh, yeah, that sounds okay, fine. But the question then is, well, why has it taken 4 years to do this, and why do you have this surge in this new strategy when just in October President Bush said we're, quote, winning in Iraq? I mean, if you got a winning strategy, you don't change. So one of the first things was, okay, so we want to train the Iraqi army. Well, as Dr. Stan has noted a number of times before, back when the war first began, or shortly thereafter, Major General Paul Eaton was in charge of the training of the new Iraqi National Army, since they had been disbanded, and they were supposed to be given about 250 promised professional training staff, but he started out with only 6 and actually never got above half of that, and half of the 250 that he was promised. In other words, somebody made a conscious decision not to train the Iraqi army. I mean, you can't do that and expect anything but chaos, but that's exactly what they did. And so the next question I said along this logical sequence is, well, could it be that if an Iraqi National Army were quickly trained and equipped, there would be no need for a huge American military bases all over the place being constructed, facilitating the, quote, more permanent role in Gulf regional security, end quote, desired by the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, who is largely running the Bush administration's foreign policy, at least. And so that's the first question and the first answer, that we apparently for a long time didn't really want to train the Iraqi National Army because we wanted this more permanent role in the Gulf regional security, and that's why we got these huge military bases all over the place. And in addition to the military considerations, another factor would be oil and gas have played a large part in the American policies concerning Iraq. And the reason I mention that is, although they seem different, it actually sort of goes together. And the way you can see that is, if you look at a book called The New Great Game, subtitled Blood and Oil in Central Asia, it was published just 3-4 years ago, by a fellow named Lutz Cleveland. And in there, you will also see not just written text, and you can actually find this on the Internet. He has maps, and you click on the maps, and you have overlays. And he has overlays of the countries. You know, you'll just see the countries and the water, and then he'll have one that'll say the title of each country, and then he'll have another one that'll give gas pipelines, and then another overlay oil pipelines, and then another one gas pipelines proposed or planned, then another one overlay oil pipelines. You know, and you keep doing that over and over again, and what you find is when you get this map all together. Of the 15 or American or British military bases in that whole area in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Georgia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, 11 of the 15 are near oil pipelines or planned oil or gas pipelines, and the other four are, of course, on the seacoast. Now, do you really think that's coincidental? So what we want is this permanent military presence there, but not just for military action. It's actually to defend these pipelines or proposed pipelines. In other words, they're not stuck out in the middle of wherever. They're really near these pipelines. So I said in the next logical step, well, now, is this coincidental? The next thing I say is one of the reasons proposed for Saddam Hussein's removal was concern about oil and gas, as expressed by an independent task force sponsored by the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy and the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations. A lot of people just look at PNAC, the Project of the New American Century. But at the same time PNAC was doing its thing, so was this James Baker Institute and the CFR. They had individuals on there like Kenneth Lay of Enron, Infamy, as well as a lot of big oil executives. Okay, the next step is various other reasons have also been offered for our not quickly training the Iraqi National Army. Seem rather logical for not providing the Army with the arms and equipment necessary to be an effective force. I mean, you would think after 3.5 years that they would be very, very well equipped. Whatever forces there are. Well, if you go to the average Iraqi soldier, he's got practically nothing. I mean, they don't have the tanks we have. They don't have the Humvees we have. They don't have all of the military hardware, the equipment, the armor.
They don't have the body armor to protect themselves with. We send them out there to be slaughtered.
Well, basically that's right. I mean, we didn't even give our own troops armor to protect them for a while, and certainly not the Iraqis. I mean, but. You know, after 3.5 years, I mean, I think we've been there 46 months, almost 4 years, you would think that, you know, by this time, some people, you know, maybe one battalion, maybe, of the Iraqi National Army would have the equipment used to engage in this conflict over there. Well, so then I move on, logically, a couple other questions. Two other reasons that supposedly we have not trained speedily, the new Iraqi National Army, is they say, well, you know, it's been infiltrated by insurgents. And, you know, if we train those Sunnis and Shiites also, that'll only allow them more efficiently to kill each other in what has now become largely a sectarian power struggle or civil war. So, you know, that's another rationale they offer as to why we have not quickly trained. I keep saying quickly, 3.5 years is not that quick. Why we haven't trained them. But what has thus far been missing from the debate, I believe, between Republicans and Democrats in this country is, again, and I put this in quotes because I use it over and over again in this article, training for what? Republicans advocate an increase in the U.S. forces. You know, they support President Bush. Let's have this surge. But even the Democrats, they don't want to say, well, you know, let's quit, get on the boats, come home, that's it, we retreat, we fail, we lose. They talk about, well, let's have redeployment or a reduction in force, but it's to self-defendable areas, you know, and then we can come back in if we're needed to support the Iraqi troops and so on. So they don't really talk about withdrawing precipitously. And they say, well, you know, that's our strategy because if we don't do that, then the Iraqis just they'll seem to rely on us indefinitely, and we need to get them serious, because they need to be trained and bear the military burden more quickly, and so on. And so we hear that, you know, that's some rationale. But then I say to myself again when I'm watching this debate between the Republicans and Democrats, that, well, okay, training for what? They never get to that next level. Okay, now, the reason I keep asking that is a national army, any national army, like the U.S. Army, is trained for and tasked with defending a nation, and we'll pick up after the break.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a few moments or two with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And certainly we have to understand that it took us 3.5 years to win the Second World War. It will be 4 years in 1st of March of this year that we invaded Iraq, and we're still bound down. Well, you pick up the story there, Dennis.
Okay. A national army, any national army, the U.S. Army, you know, well, whoever it is, the Czechoslovakian army, whatever, they're usually trained for and tasked with defending the nation against some sort of external aggressor, an invasion from abroad. That's what an army is usually for. And there's good reason why for over a century we've had posse comitatus laws that have prohibited our army from being used in civilian law enforcement. There's a number of reasons, and they've been explored thoroughly. But if you think about it, that's exactly what we are asking the Iraqi National Army to do. They're not being trained to resist an invasion from the Syrian army or the Iranian army or the Russian army or Chinese army. What we're asking them to do, what we're training them to do, is to provide security within the country. Within the country of Iraq. That means Sunnis will be asked to kill their fellow Sunnis, and Shiites will be asked to kill their fellow Shiites who resist. So the question I ask is, okay, if that's what we're really training them to do, how would you feel as a listener listening to Radio Liberty, how would you feel if President Bush or any other president, you know, Clinton, whoever, doesn't matter, ordered you, let's say you're a soldier, I want you to go into your home state, your hometown, and I want you to enforce this policy. And if your neighbors, you know, the guy and woman who live next door to you, they don't like it, well, if they resist, you just kill them. Basically, that's what we're asking them to do. You'll remember, I think it was about a year or so ago, when they started this training, so to speak, not very well, but they started it to build up an Iraqi national army. A particular group of soldiers were ordered to attack, they called them insurgents, but they was really members of their own sectarian group, to attack the town. And I remember seeing the nightly news, and it actually showed those soldiers, they didn't just put their arms down, they ripped off their uniforms. They took the uniforms off. They, you know, that's not what we're doing. Well, we volunteered to be part of this Iraqi National Army to defend the nation. Defend the nation against external forces, an army, you know, an invading army like U.S. troops would do. And so, as I've written a number of times before about the sectarian nature of this problem, it's as if Protestants in the U.S. were forced to live under Catholic religious law or vice versa. That's how serious it is. There isn't any separation of church and state or mosque and state there. And so, some American analysts counter when I make that suggestion. Well, no. They're not being asked to do that. You know, they're only trying to root out the insurgents who they define as Al-Qaeda types. And if you stop and think about that, again, that's sort of a generality, a standard response that you get from these people when you raise this question that that I've just asked. But if you look at the figures, and the figures of our own military, the foreign insurgents, the sort of invaders, really constitute a very, very small percent. I'd say, you know, 7%, 10% of the problem there. The foreign insurgents, the Al-Qaeda types in Iraq, are not the ones who are killing a lot of the American soldiers there. It really is a fairly small contingent. They're primarily being harbored by the minority Sunni Muslims, because they feel the Sunnis as a minority, they're being oppressed now in terms of retribution by the Shiite majority.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and Dr. Cuddy makes the point, and I think it's a very, very valid point, that what we have basically is a civil war. The president denies, consistently denies it's a civil war, but it's a civil war between the Shia Muslims and the Sunni Muslims, and we've done everything we could to incite this animosity between the two groups, and now we've got this civil war going. So now we want the army, of course, to go in, and we want the Shias to kill Shias and the Sunnis to kill Sunnis. And do you think if they're soldiers, they're going to kill the people who look at the world with the same eyes that they do, that are, you know, that they tend to identify with? And that, after all, most of what's going on today, you know, as far as the attacks on the Americans, is because we are occupying their land, and they think that we're there to steal their oil. And they're fighting the occupiers of their land. We said we were only going to come in. We promised them. We dropped flyers. We're going to come in, get rid of Saddam Hussein. We're going to pull out. It's 4 years. Now, the president says we're fighting terrorism. We're not fighting terrorism. We're recruiting terrorists into the Al-Qaeda movement. Yes, there are a handful of people coming from our good friends in Saudi Arabia, sent there and financed by our good friends in Saudi Arabia, and a few people coming in from Pakistan, our good friends in Pakistan, which we finance, and probably some from Iran and some from Syria. Certainly that they are Shia Muslims who identify with this, but they make up, as Dr. Cuddy says, maybe 7 or 10% of the opposition at the maximum. Most of them are people there who want to get us out of occupying their country. So pick the story up there.
Sure. So what you have here is a case of the minority Sunnis harboring the insurgents, the outsiders who come in, because they feel that they need help against the Shiite majority, who is, through their death squads and other ways, seeking retribution for what Saddam Hussein did. He was a Sunni. To them, the Shiites, for so many years. And that's why you hear those, you know, al-Sadr being rung out on that picture of Saddam's execution. They keep chanting over and over again, this is a Shiite retribution against Saddam Hussein, a Sunni. And the same thing is going on with other Sunnis. You had another suicide bombing today and so forth. So it's largely now sectarian violence, which is causing the major part of the problem there. And it's not a case of the insurgents being, you know, in one corner quadrant of Baghdad. It's not that clear. It's not like, okay, here's the arrow, you know, insurgents here, so to speak. There isn't like a Sadr city and an insurgent city that you easily identify to drop a bunch of bombs on them and the problem is solved. So if you attack the, quote, insurgents, you're going to be attacking the Sunnis because they're working with them and harboring them, largely, they feel, to protect themselves from the Shiites. So going down this logical train of thought, as I'm doing, and which anybody would do, any police chief mounting, you know, some sort of operation against a gang or in this country, in Los Angeles or wherever, would do this. But apparently we don't. You know, our leaders don't, the talk show hosts don't, the guests don't, and most Americans don't. They just, you know, are satisfied with these sort of bland generalities for 3.5 years here. So if you think the Sunni soldiers in the Iraqi National Army are going to go in and attack their fellow Sunnis, including perhaps their brother, you know, their sister, their son, their daughter, I don't think so. Well, you might say, what about the Shiites in the Iraqi National Army going into the Sunni areas to root out those insurgents? Which would mean rooting out, attacking and killing Sunnis as well. Would you think they'd do that? And my response to that is, oh, sure they would, gladly. In fact, that's the problem. I mean, that's what's going on. And that is furthering the sectarian violence, the Shiites against the Sunnis and the insurgents against the Shiites. And so if we try to intervene, you know, we're going to go in there and lead and occupy and not only root them out, but stay, who are we going to do that to? Are we going to go in with the Shiites, with the Iraqi National Army? Now, remember, here you are, and you've got this Iraqi National Army. Now, if there are Sunnis in here, they're probably not going to kill their fellow Sunnis. So who are you going to go into the Sunni neighborhood with? You're going to go in there with members of the Shiite sect of the Iraqi National Army? Okay, fine. That'll be great. Then the U.S. will be perceived as taking sides, right? So now the Sunnis, who we really say we must have as part of this coalition, this Iraqi national government, we don't want to separate, you know, Kurds and Sunnis and Shia, three different areas. No. We have to have the Iraqi national government. What do you think the Sunnis are going to think about that? We going in with the Shiite members of the Iraqi National Army into their neighborhoods, the Sunnis, and killing them as well as the insurgents who they're harboring.
Well, we're just going to have to take a quick break here, but I'd like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, our leaders, I'm talking about the Paul Bremers, I'm talking about the Henry Kissingers, I'm talking about the elite Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Elite, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, they're very brilliant men. They could not have done such a terrible job unintentionally. They wanted chaos. They got chaos. Well, Dr. Cuddy, you picked the story up there. And they certainly have their chaos. And that's exactly what they wanted, because if they'd actually done the job right, we would have pulled out and we would have gone home a long time ago. Our boys, our generals, they're doing the best job they can, but they've never been given enough men, never been given adequate supplies, and, of course, never been allowed to win the war. It's Vietnam all over again, but they keep saying, this is not Vietnam. Of course it's Vietnam. Our boys are fighting and bleeding and suffering and dying and being put into an incredible situation where they're not allowed to win the war. Go right ahead.
That's right. And, you know, if it was just a military sort of problem, it wouldn't be that hard to solve. But once again, if we go with the Shiites into the Sunni areas, then we're perceived as taking the side of the Shiites. If, for whatever reason, we decide to go with the Sunni members of the Iraqi National Army into the Shiite areas against the Shiite death squads, well, then the Shiites, who are the majority, are going to be saying, oh, well, now you're taking side of the Sunnis. And we're, after all, the majority. You know, we were elected, we're the majority. How come you're taking the sides of those Sunnis who have those insurgents they're harboring? So it's a continuation of this deliberate no-win situation. And so I could go on analyzing this, and if your listeners want to, they can see part one. This is part two. Part one is also on newswithviews.com. But the main point here that I'm trying to make is that the president, it seems to me, and nearly all of the congressional Democrats and Republicans, you know, all the major media pundits, talk show hosts, nearly all Americans, they never seem to ask what I consider a very basic, simple question, the one I've been posing, is training for what? What are we training these people for? And then following logically the consequences of their answers. And that's one reason. That's one reason we have this mess in Iraq today. But it's not the only one. What you got to remember is, and again, you can go back and look at these figures here. I think today, now, this is, you know, 46, going on 47 months that we've been there. I think today, even in Baghdad, which is not as secure as Basra, I mean, you know, there are other places, but Baghdad's the capital. Even in Baghdad, where you do have an ability to concentrate your initiative, I mean, it's not like you've got to go running out behind sand dunes and finding somebody, you know, some Al-Qaeda member hiding underground or somewhere and pick him off because he's a sniper or something. You can literally concentrate your force. The green zone is there in Baghdad. Even in Baghdad, I believe, if you check the figures, it's something like they only have 4.5 hours of electricity a day.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Doctor, Cuddy is simply pointing out that even in Baghdad, the capital where we have all of our forces concentrated, where we have the green zone, where our people could live very, very comfortably in air condition, barracks, and of course where there's security. But out on the streets of Baghdad, they have electricity 4.5 hours a day, water a couple of hours a day, no jobs, no security. Certainly the people of Baghdad, you know, never know when they're going to be caught in the middle of a gunfight. They live in constant fear. The Shias never know when they're going to be kidnapped by the Sunnis. The Sunnis never know when the Shia death squad's going to come into their area and kill 100 or so of their people and kill their women and children. People live in terrible, terrible insecurity. All as a direct result of not a failed policy, but of a very successful policy on the people who wanted to create chaos there and continue this war. The First World War, we defeated Germany in 3.5 years. We've been at this war for 47 months. And are we closer? Are things more secure now than they were 2 years ago? They're going from bad to worse. And it's not happening by accident that the military win the war. It would have been one thing. They never allowed the military to win the war. They never gave them adequate troops. And believe me, Donald Rumsfeld's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. Well, before we go on, I simply want to mention that we carry at Radio Liberty a number of Dr. Cuddy's books, his book Cover-Up, his book The Road to Socialism, his book on mental health screening, his book Conspiracy. It's a little pamphlet, but we recommend it. His book on the timeline to the New World Order, educational timeline to the New World Order. But a book we really need to get back in print would be his book Secret Records Revealed. It's been out of print for some years. One of the most important books in my library. We've actually updated the book. We've got an index for it. And we're trying to raise help from people out there in the listening audience. And we're about halfway towards what we need to get the book reprinted. If you'd like to get a pre-publication case of the books, of Dr. Cuddy's book, it'll be almost 300 pages, about 280 pages, with an index and updated. You'll get a case of the books for $149.95 plus shipping, and you won't be billed until we go to press. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We need all of the information we can get to begin to get the American people to realize that there is another agenda behind what's going on today, an agenda that very, very few people ever speak about. So Secret Records Revealed, if you'd like to help Dr. Cuddy and I get the book back in print, 1-800-544-8927. So you pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay. Basically then, toward the end of this particular part of the series, the final couple of questions I would raise is, Americans for some reason tend not to see things through the eyes of the people who we're affecting. So I would urge your listeners, it gets to about 130 or so degrees in Iraq in the summer. So picture yourself, you, the listener, and you're living in Death Valley, and it's the summer, and it's like 130 degrees or so, and you don't have any air condition because there's only electricity 4.5 hours a day, and you're stuck there. I mean, you can't go to San Diego or somewhere, and you have no job, and you have no potable water, or only, you know, a small amount of potable water, and not in every town. Actually, when you think about it, the Iraqis are amazingly patient people with this horrible situation, which we have allowed to develop in the first place and to continue.
And they had electricity all the time before we got in there. They had water all the time. They had sewer. They had jobs. And we closed down the factories. And, of course, Paul Bremer said, oh, I don't like government-run factories. I want people to come in here, private concerns, and open up these factories, buy them up, and get them going. None of the factories, nobody's ever going to go in and buy a closed factory in a war zone. They knew what they were doing. And so these people have no jobs. How do they get anything to feed their families? Why, you get $100 for setting off an explosive device. Somebody's putting up the money, and these people will do anything to get money to feed their families. Why would you create massive unemployment? Paul Bremer is a brilliant man. Why did he close down all those government-run factories? These people run the world. They know what they're doing. They're extremely clever, but they're also extremely diabolical. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, and so the last thing before I move on to a different subject is if this is a logical sequence that I've gone through, and if one point after another just seemed to be absolutely foolish in terms of what the normal person, the normal commander-in-chief, the normal executive branch of a government, whatever it is, whether it's the mayor or governor of a state or mayor of a town or whatever would do, as Dr. Stan says, there must be some sort of other agenda here, And one of the points I raised at the very end is this power leak, who I've mentioned many times, as far as they're concerned, what might be the reason for what has gone on? Or one reason, just one reason. There's many reasons. And so the point I put here in terms of this training for what, which I've mentioned four or five times throughout this piece, is could it be that what the U.S. Army, what the U.S., the executive, President Bush and his administration, is asking the Iraqi National Army to do is really designed to set a precedent for the U.S. military being used against Americans inside the U.S., wiping out, in effect, posse comitatus protections here. Because remember, the normal use of a military force, an army, is to defend against external aggression. But we're switching that here. And so what you have in saying, okay, you Sunnis and Shiites in the Iraqi National Army, you go in there and, you know, do whatever you need to any resistors among your own sect, your own religious group, could that be setting a precedent for the U.S. military to do the same thing here? And you would say, oh, well, you know, our soldiers, we're different, you know. We'd never have good Baptist soldiers going into some Baptist church and, you know, rooting out some Baptist who's not going along with the administration's agenda. But remember that that survey that they did of Marines several years ago. And people said, well, you know, it was only, I think, some like 29 or 25% of the Marines said, yes, we would use military force against somebody who did not voluntarily hand over their weapon if that's what we wanted to do.
I think the word was shoot them, kill them.
Yeah. Kill them. And the individual who conducted the survey said, well, there's another way of looking at that. You know, it wasn't only 25 or 29%. It's that if you take 25 or 29% of the military, you can literally create a very, very large group of soldiers, and you put them all together, and then you can send them anywhere in the country you want, and that's exactly what they'll do. So what that really revealed is there's a very large number of U.S. soldiers who would be willing to do exactly what we're asking the Iraqi National Army to do. And so that's why I raised that as the possibility of a precedent that is being set. You gotta watch these people, the paralite. What they try to do is set precedents. I mentioned in part one of the series, for example, these polls. Now, you had a poll immediately, I mean, not 2-3 days later, but immediately after 9/11, ABC Washington Post asking the American public, would you be willing to give up some of your freedoms in order to have security? And two-thirds said yes of the public. And then shortly after the Iraq war began, they asked another poll question, and it said, well, you Americans, would you be in favor of torturing any people who belong to the military force operating against you in order to get, you know, information? And again, two-thirds of the American public said, yeah, torture, that's fine with us. Shortly thereafter, we learn of Abu Ghraib, not by accident, I might add. That was released. And so, once again, you had the situation of somebody being allowed to film, to do videotape, and to circulate to Al Jazeera the hanging of Saddam, and this chanting, this chant by the Shiites who were doing the hanging there. And again, that wasn't by accident either. And so what they often do is what I called in part one the psychological probe to see what the public, the Iraqi public, you know, the Arab public, the Muslim public, the American general public, whatever, would be willing to tolerate. And so a lot of this stuff is psychological. Now, in the short time that we have left, one of the other books that Radio Liberty is offering is my Road to Socialism book, which is a booklet previously, but it's been updated and has a good index. And I just wanted to hit some high spots because, as I say, there's this power elite, and I've explained before how the ultimate goal of these people is a world socialist government, because it's supposed to be a synthesis of Eastern communism and Western capitalism into a world socialist government. And since that's the way we're heading, I thought this was a very timely point to update this book, because it's talking about exactly that, the road to socialism. And I'll just hit some of the high spots in here. I indicated the first about how Cecil Rhodes is a part of this, and he had this secret society to take the government of the world, literally. And the plan was mapped out by one of his individuals, Percy Corbett was his name, saying how they would have these regional economic arrangements and then link them up. And I then proceed in the introduction to the book to give a specific example of a Rhodes Scholar, Richard Gardner, talking about how they would use GATT to erode national sovereignty piece by piece.
Now that's a general agreement on tariff and trade.
Right. Within which the World Trade Organization operates, which is a bunch of unelected bureaucrats, which literally have told our Congress what laws to change in this country, and our Congress obediently did so. I then mentioned the concept was furthered by H.G. Wells in his book, The Open Conspiracy, where he talks about this this socialist government to come. And I go through the process of showing how various administrations, Woodrow Wilson's administration and his chief advisor, Colonel House, had a plan for socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx, as he said. And then I also mentioned the Fabian Socialists, who are another prominent group that got together with House's Inquiry Group, as it was called, to set up the League of Nations, and the CFR came out of that, so on. And then I begin the book by giving sort of a historical background of the French Revolution and how its principles have come forward, and Karl Marx's father-in-law, Ludwig von Westphalen, taught him the process, the dialectical process that had come before from Hegel. And then I mentioned Cecil Rhodes' mentor, John Ruskin, and how this was his attitude as well. These elitist socialists would get together with the Fabian socialists, the intellectual socialists, and the Fabians would launch the London School of Economics, which H.G. Wells called a plot. He literally called this a plot in his book, New Worlds for Old. I give citations of people, academics at the time, who said there literally was this elite in control of things. And Edward Allsworth Ross, a prominent individual, wrote a book called Social Control, saying exactly that. There is this elite, this not K-N-O-T of elitists, who run things. I also quote from Lord of the World, a very important book, and it was important because it was written so early, 1907. And it talked about the American socialism to come, and it would come out of the Western scheme of free trade. I also include a cartoon by a prominent individual in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And the reason the cartoon's in there is that it shows Karl Marx in this book, Socialism Under His Arm, is being greeted by these big money capitalists like John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, and others, to show how they really network with each other. I then go through that process of the First World War and how that proceeded under Wilson. And then we get into the 1920s and how through educational process, John Dewey went over to Russia. He loved the Bolsheviks, loved what they were doing. In 1928, he wrote that up in the New Republic magazine. The very next year, he writes a book back in this country called Individualism, Old and New, and he says what we're in is for some kind of socialism. He said you may call it, liberalism, but it'll be socialism. And then in the 30s, I show how FDR came in and through the results of the Great Depression was able to institute national planning, which is furthering down the road to socialism. And that's not just my opinion. I put quotes from Al Smith, who had supported FDR in 1932, but in 1936 I put a quote by Al Smith saying if you laid down the Socialist Party platform and what FDR had done, you would think they were exactly alike. I talk about where this came from largely. Harold Ickes under FDR and his national planning actually got it from what was called PEP in England. It was sort of the Fabian's idea, and John Maynard Keynes and others. And I indicate in this country how even at the time, what you had was the communists pushing socialism. William Z. Foster was head of the Communist Party, but he wrote Toward a Soviet America, in which he emphasized there would be this sort of socialism that would be here. Then I put how the Carnegie Foundation, other foundations supported this. I quote Harold Lasky regarding the American Historical Association's Commission on the Social Studies, saying, stripped of its verbiage, this is a socialist plan for America. I put other quotes by famous people, Fabian socialists like Bertrand Russell, saying how we would get socialism through mass psychology. And then moving up into the 50s, Rowan Gaither, head of the Ford Foundation, tells Norman Dodd that they're really about this merger, this synthesis of the U.S. and USSR to merge them. I quote U.N. documents and people regarding that organization, how they're pushing socialism. And moving up into more modern times, I put Hillary's friend, Michael Lerner, in the early 70s, literally wrote a book. They're very, very close at that time. And it was called The New Socialist Revolution, showing how what they would do is link up education in this country and work, you know, link those two things together. I give examples of how they actually planned. They had this model project back under FDR called Centerville. It was a literal town where they would move people around and see how they could influence and each other under this planning, this national planning that they had. In the 70s, I include Zbigniew Brzezinski's Between Two Ages, where he's lauding Karl Marx and saying he's wonderful, and PPBS, which is a planning mechanism, and he says we will be manipulated by elites. He actually admits that.
I think it's really so important that people understand this whole thing, you know, is really an elite concept to control us common folks.
Right.
The whole idea is to institute the new feudalistic masters. This is why the people of great wealth have always encouraged communism and socialism, because they are the antithesis of Americanism, where the power of the government is limited over the lives of the people, and the people can be free. Go ahead, Dennis. You've got about 30 seconds to wrap up.
Okay, then I put, since you mentioned feudalism, W.J. Gent's book, Our Benevolent Feudalism. 100 years ago, the famous author Jack London said that's the model that these oligarchs and plutocrats are using, and you'll find more current quotes that you'll find of interest as well.
God bless you, Dennis. Thank you so very much for being with us. And of course, all of this information is available. What book were you summarizing?
That's The Road to Socialism, which you are offering.
All right, we have it, The Road to Socialism. You'll want to get that as well. God bless. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope that you will take very seriously what Dr. Cuddy has said, because this information is so very, very important today. Socialism and communism are sincere, benevolent, idealistic schemes. They sound really wonderful, and they appeal to people in academia, and they appeal to many idealistic people who do not understand all of these ideas are financed by people of great wealth, the very people that many times the people in academia and the idealists oppose. But they do not understand that America was established where the power of government was limited so men could be free. And the people of great wealth hated that. They wanted a system by which government could control every aspect of human endeavor, and they could control the government. And that's what this scheme was all about. It was really very, very, very clever. And so, on one hand, they pretended they were against communism. Communism was the enemy. On the other hand, they were financing communism. And I can tell you that for almost 44 years, I have subscribed to the communist publications, when it was the People's Daily World and the Weekly World, and I don't even know what they call it today, but the World and the Communist World, and I have never yet seen them condemn the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission or the organizations of these people of great wealth. Why? Because the whole communist movement in America, indeed, largely throughout the world, is funded by these exact same people. You've recently seen the miracle that's take place in China. You've seen these cities sprout up out of nowhere with multi-story buildings, skyscraper buildings, and broad highways, and increasing prosperity. And how did it all come about? With money from the World Bank, your money, from the International Monetary Fund, American money, Export-Import Bank, American money, Asian Development Bank, American money, General Motors, Ford, Goldman Sachs, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citibank. Go to the Wall Street Journal and pick it up and see how all of this is being funded by people here in the United States. We are creating this tyrannical dictatorship, but a very prosperous tyrannical dictatorship. You'll be at the weekend edition of the Washington Post, as I do. And the center section, at least once a month, is telling you how wonderful things are in tyrannical China, where there is absolutely no freedom for the individual, where they still would determine how many children you're going to have, and of course they put you in jail if you profess Christianity, all funded with American money. Understand what this is about. It is the greatest scam in the world. We're creating the best enemy our money can buy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope that many of you out there will heed Dr. Cuddy's words. Dr. Cuddy's one of the greatest researchers and the smartest people we have on our side, and I'm privileged to call him a friend. We hope many of you want to get his book, Road to Socialism, and of course we hope many of you will be willing to participate with me and help us republish Dr. Cuddy's book, Secret Records Revealed. And it's going to be a very, very powerful tool in our armamentarium. And if you, of course, make a pledge for $149.95 now, you'll get your case of books as soon as they're printed. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You'll certainly want to get our new tape set on the Military Commission Act, because it covers the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act, and you have to understand that they have suspended the posse comitatus laws here in the United States because they're planning on having a military dictatorship here. Why else would they suspend the posse comitatus laws? If you haven't gone into the background of the the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act, you need to study it. And even Liberal Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont has said this legislation encourages the president to establish martial law across America. Understand there are people who have a different worldview. If you have not seen our material on concentration camps, you need to get it. We have a four-tape set. We have some videos. We have a video called America Behind Barbed Wire. We have, of course, written information on how they'll treat the civilian internees in the military camps in America. You can get the concentration camp special. And I would simply ask you two questions. Why do you think within the last month they appropriated $38 million to rehabilitate the 10 Japanese concentration camps where 110,000 Japanese citizens, American citizens, were placed during the Second World War? Why are they rehabilitating those camps? Well, the rationale is why we're rehabilitating them, because we never want the Americans to forget how terrible it was to put American citizens in concentration camps in America. But if that is really the case, why have they appropriated $385 million for Halliburton to build two concentration camps in America? And if you doubt that, I want you to go up on Google, and you Google in Halliburton, $385 million, concentration or detention camps, and see what comes up. Read about it. Ladies and gentlemen, do you care about your freedom? Do you care about your freedom? Are you really cared about the fact we have evil and wicked people working in our country? Have you read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness? Do you realize that there really are people out there who worship Satan? Have you ever read about Operation Paperclip, where at the end of the Second World War, thousands of wicked and evil Nazi war criminals were brought to America under Operation Paperclip, and 10,000 Nazis were helped to escape to South America by your intelligence agencies and British intelligence and the Rat Line? Look it up, Operation Paperclip. Have you ever heard of Operation Keelhaul, where at the end of the Second World War, why, of course, the United States and Great Britain and France rehabilitated almost 6 million Russians and who had been captured and defected to the Nazis and sent them back to Russia to be killed? Operation Keelhaul, we have a video on that, produced by BBC, of course, you can look it up on the Internet. Do you know that we left almost 20,000, over 20,000 American soldiers? We abandoned them at the end of the Second World War? You can get that information. It's called the Helms Committee Report from Radio Liberty. We got the Helms Committee Report put out by the Foreign Relations Department and totally suppressed by the controlled media. Would you like to know how the media is controlled? We have a book on the new media monopoly written by Professor Ben Bagdakian. Learn what's going on. And then join us in this epic struggle for the very survival of Christian civilization. America is under attack because there are wicked people, not in Iraq, but right here in America. And we're sending our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but they're never going to be allowed to win in Iraq any more than they were allowed to win in Vietnam. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
On the Information Radio Network, I'm John Russell. A federal appeals court is reinstating a key terror charge against alleged Al-Qaeda operative Jose Padilla. Correspondent Tony Winton brings us the story.
The ruling by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta is critical because it means that once again Jose Padilla can face life in prison. Padilla was once held as an enemy combatant accused of plotting to explode a radioactive dirty bomb, but those charges do not appear in the federal case against him. A federal judge here dropped the charge that Padilla conspired to murder, kidnap, and maim, saying it duplicated other counts in the same indictment. But the 11th Circuit disagreed. Trial is set for April 16th, but it could be delayed again.
The Los Angeles Times.